You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. And tonight's episode is Face of the Enemy. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
James from London. How are you doing, James? It's been a mighty long time since we've talked.
It has. In fact, the computer tells me it's been 3 months. I don't know if I trust the computer, but I probably trust the computer more than I trust my own memory. So yeah, it's been a bucket load of time.
Yes.
And so as a result, Lou, as we stand on the 25th of January, Happy New Year. And I'm not talking about Chinese New Year.
No.
I'm happy. Despite it being Chinese New Year today as well.
Oh, and Merry Christmas too.
Indeed, yeah. And
I hope you had a happy Thanksgiving. And we can keep going backwards, by the way.
We can.
Okay, so I feel bad about that, but there have been changes here. Don't ask any questions, and I won't have to tell you any lies. But I am no longer at the casino. I'm now doing my own thing.
You're running your own casino?
Oh, no.
Lose casino on the side. You do blackjack on the side.
Yeah, everybody wins. Everybody wins. So I'm driving for Uber and Lyft and DoorDash, Grubhub and Postmates, and you know, and I could choose any of those at any time. Within the last few days, we had a pretty good snowstorm, snow, sleet, ice, and that was a day I said, "Nah, I'm not driving." And that's a kind of freedom I like. I don't have to work overnights now, so I'm done with the overnight. I drop my wife off and I go to work, and then I can come home, let out the dogs, and go back to work, have some lunch. You know, it's a pretty nice freedom as far as the money. It's very comparable. This week I made better than what I thought I would. And since I'm driving for myself, I'm working for myself, I get to deduct the mileage off my taxes, so the mileage takes a lot of the income and decreases it, so where I'm only paying taxes on very little. That's pretty good, actually.
Well I'm going to trust you that you're doing everything legally here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Not trying to swindle anyone.
You know, so I'm going to tell you, I say if you're going to cheat people, cheat anybody you want to in this world, but do not cheat the IRS. That is one thing you do not want to screw with. You don't want the KGB, the IRS on you. So, yeah, no, I've got, here. As you can see in this piece of paper here that I'm holding in my hand, I've got the
So, Lou, first of all, we're an audio podcast, and secondly, you don't even have your camera on.
I don't. So no. Close your eyes, everyone, and just pretend that you're looking at this. No, basically, I've got a log here that has the date I worked, the time I started, which is for my own records, because then it tells me how much I'm making per hour. And then it has my beginning mileage, the ending mileage, and from that in between tells me how much of a deduction I get to write off for what I made that day. And I've got a spreadsheet, Excel spreadsheet, that's so elaborate.
So Lou, I was about to just jump in there and say, you haven't done what I generally consider to be the most, you know, quote unquote male thing, which is I built a spreadsheet for this.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have so many spreadsheets.
Oh, yeah.
I've got my last like 10 years worth of pay slips in a spreadsheet somewhere.
Oh, wow.
And I've got a graph, and I look at my graph every now and again, and I go, that's a nice graph. I mean, why would I do that? What's wrong with me?
Nothing. And I'll tell you why. I'm now pulling something on my computer. Let's see, documents, family sheets, previous years. I could tell you what came out of my checking account in 2008.
Let me see. Okay, I can't do that. Do you and your wife have a shared bank account?
Yes.
Okay, because you know the wife and I do as well. I don't look at what's going in that bank account because there's just too much. There's too much to get my head around. So all I do is I check in every year and make sure it's okay. You know, maybe every month I check just before payday hits, make sure it's not too bad. And then as long as it's within a range, I kind of become comfortable and I look forward. Okay. But I can't track things. I mean, because with five kids and with, you know, lessons and schools and this and that and emergencies, this, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, you need a new trumpet. You say, what? Who plays the trumpet? And that kind of stuff. It's just too much. So I just let it all go.
Oh, well. But, you know, as they say over here, the majority of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. And so it's critical that I keep track of everything that comes in and everything that goes out. Like, here I have January 1, 2008, we went to McDonald's for $4.90. So it's probably just one of us that got something at McDonald's. Our insurance for our car was $83.56 in 2008. Now it's $400 and some when it includes my house and my daughter's car. And her driving.
Hang on, 1 second. $48, what, per month? Is that per month?
It's right now $504 a month. It's going to go down a little bit from there since she turned 18.
So $500 a month?
Yes, that's two cars. Both of us driving, her and I only.
Right, yeah.
And my homeowner's.
Okay, I would not be prepared to pay that kind of money for insurance because I assume most of that insurance is for your daughter.
Right.
Right?
It is.
So, can young people, can't they walk? I mean, I know it's different being in a big kind of metropolitan area than maybe than in the States as well. It's more car-centric. But there's no way I'm paying multiple thousands of pounds a year for car insurance. No way.
Yeah. No, she can't walk. I mean, she is about 2 miles away from school, but when it's, you know,
well, my kids are about 2 miles away from school. They walk to school.
Well, that's true, but how many days, how many times do they walk in sub-zero temperatures?
Well, I mean, not too many.
It would be bitter. It would be very, very bitter. And she could take the bus. There is a bus that, you know, city bus that goes around. But then, you know, she goes to work and where she was working, way out West Omaha. By the time she got off of work, there's no buses that come back.
Well, actually, so what you're doing here is that you're giving me an out, which is that, well, if she's working, she can surely pay for her own insurance.
Yeah, no way. Yeah. So January 22nd, 2008, my paycheck was $780, $750, and out of that was our $300 mortgage. So, I mean, yeah, I've got records all the way to 2008. I've got copies of our tax returns. I think even further, 2003, which I should take that out. I don't want the IRS to know that. But, you know, I think they say you should hold on to records for 3 years. But I want to be able to protect myself in case there is ever an audit for any reason. So, yeah, I'm on it. So, anyway, we were going to talk about Face of the Enemy, but guys, that's going to have to wait a while because in the last few days, Star Trek Picard has hit the screen. And I know you're going to listen to this about a week after it was put out, maybe a little more than a week. But we're going to talk about it for a second. James?
Okay, Lou, yes. Okay, one thing I should say is that Star Trek Picard was announced at Star Trek Las Vegas in 2018. Mm-hmm. And I know this because I was there. This was the year that I was I went to visit there. The wife came with me. I don't know how I managed to convince the wife that she should come to a Star Trek convention. But she was there that day. I think it would have been the Saturday. And we just happened to be kind of like in the main hall and just out of nowhere, because there was nothing announced. It was just, I believe it was Alex Kurtzman turned up and he went, oh, by the way, blah, 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 blah. I've got some news that, you know, a certain someone is going to deliver. Oh. And then Patrick Stewart walks out and then he says, you know, he says that, you know, they're now all, they're going ahead for a Picard series set in the future. And he kind of mentioned that it was going to be slightly different to what we had seen before, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And now it's only 2 years and a bit later. And we've now got the show. I kind of think that's a quick turnaround, because at the time, Patrick Stewart mentioned that they had no scripts. And I know that this series has been somewhat strained in terms of the production side. They've been through a lot of people, a lot of iterations and things like that. Yeah, you know, it's now good to be able to be on the receiving end of some new Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I hope I don't get anybody mad, but it seems to me they had a kind of a slow start to it. I'm having a hard time getting past his age and the fact that he would take on enemies at his age. And this girl that shows up at his vineyard, and the CGI is, it's 100 times better than the Next Generation ever was.
Well, I mean, in complete fairness, I reckon that it probably costed them 100 times more per episode than they spent on the Next Generation. I mean, maybe not 100 times, but there's, you know, there is significant amount of money being spent here.
I would say so, yeah. As far as the quality of the episode, it was good. It's an interesting one. You know, he goes through his history, his artifacts. That was pretty interesting. But I think, I hope it gets better as it goes on.
I have to say that, I mean, I watched the episode in two chunks, because we get this on the Friday. I don't have the opportunity to watch it at work on the Friday, so I only watched it in the evening on the Friday, and I had a prior commitment with the wife, so I only really was able to watch it from around 10 o'clock at night, and I only watched half of it before, frankly, just conking out and you know, heading off to bed. So I watched kind of the first half, which included the Darge turning up at the vineyard and then disappearing up to about that point. And then I watched the second half, which was when they got into the big fight and stuff like that, you know, the big explosions things. I watched that earlier on today. And I have to say, I was more of a fan of the first half, because I liked the slower pace. We in the second half, or at least in the second part that I watched, there were a lot of reveals and a lot of things happened very, 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 very quickly. And we were slightly on fast forward. So what I'm talking about there is specifically the, you know, the revelation that, you know, this person could be connected to Data somehow. This person ends up fighting off the assassins and unfortunately getting killed. Then Picard going off to the Daystrom Institute, looking at the research, and then heading over to the Borg cube at the end. I kind of thought that they might have been able to space that. I mean, that was in like 15 or 19 minutes of this episode. I personally would have preferred that to be paced a little bit. And they could have paced that over like half a season or so. So I hope they have a direction of where they're going. And what we're not seeing is just them fast forwarding through what they think they need to fast forward through in order to get like a lot of attention. I hope that they've got a plan. Sometimes I felt like second season of Discovery didn't quite have a plan, and I think it also suffered from this idea of you know, always going, you know, bigger, more on the table in terms of the stakes. And I feel like slowing down is often could be a good thing, as long as it doesn't reduce it to meandering and, you know, lack of focus. But you know, you can always juggle these things, and Yeah, but overall, I mean, overall, I'm not particularly, I don't have particularly a lot to say critical of it. I think there's a lot of, you know, I hope that it can move in a direction that gets us back to, like, Star Trek-y issues. And there's enough meat on the table at the moment for them to be able to handle that. And yes, the pilot was very action packed, etc. But yeah, nothing, you know, nothing to really complain about. Oh, except I don't accept Romulans with beards. I find it hard to accept Romulans with beards. Could we not have Romulans with beards? I mean, were there Romulans with beards in Next Gen?
No.
Was that a thing?
No.
I mean, at what point was it even acknowledged that Romulans could have beards? And I appreciate that if Romulans are effectively Vulcans, and obviously Spock had a goatee in the Mirror Universe, so I accept that they probably can grow beards, but there's a part of me that, although we make fun, and in particular in the episode we're about to review, we make fun of the standardized look of a Romulan, which is the same haircut, the same uniform, and the same presentation, I find that at a certain level to be a bit more comforting than the idea that there could be a Romulan with jeans and beard. I don't know. I don't know if I'm alone in that. Anyway, sorry, Lou. I've just rolled off on one here.
Okay. Yeah, and it's, for me, I have to watch an episode more than once to really absorb it. The more I watch it, the more I catch on to what I'm actually watching. But one thing I really am not impressed with is people with guns jumping and circling and spinning as they're in the air and all this back and forth phaser fire thing. I'm not too impressed with all that action stuff. I like Star Trek when it was exploring and we were the human aspect of it, like this episode we're going to go into here in a bit. I like what happened to her. I like the way she handled herself. But all this super action, spinning in the air, firing your phasers, people vaporizing, more people, you know, there's an old saying that every martial arts fight you ever see, when it's like five people against one, you know, you go up against one of them as four dance around menacingly, waiting until you knock out each one of them one by one, instead of just coming on you at the same time. And that's one thing I noticed with the episode, is people were beaming in as they were killing other bad guys. Why didn't they all just come in at one time? Why didn't the Borg say, hey, let's go back in the past when we don't have the Enterprise chasing us?
Well, I mean, actually, to be honest with you, if you're going to beam into a place to fight, you might want to ask the question about why did you beam them out into like a cage or into like a brig, so you don't have to fight. And I do, by the way, I am very sympathetic to the view that you're expressing here in terms of the action. I don't know whether it's kind of like a reality of today's TV that it is necessary. I imagine that even if it's not a necessity, I imagine it's probably what people think is a necessity. And in about 5 years' time, we're going to have this, you know, wonderful groundbreaking show that is going to be put on air that doesn't have kind of, you know, violent leather-clad guys in helmets being beaten, and they're going to say that this is like the new way to do sci-fi, and you kind of think, yeah, you're just going back to how things were. I'm not a big fan of this, and in particular, I'm not a big fan of, well, why helmeted guys? Helmeted guys, it's such a cliche. I don't really want to see it, but I am willing to give it a pass. And I kind of thought that there's enough interesting stuff that is put on the table in terms of what they're currently doing with artificial life, what they're doing with you know, with Data's descendants, or at least his descendants in principle. The Romulans seem to be a big focus of the story. I hope we're just not burning through all of this like very quickly, like I think they did with Discovery, where they did the Klingon War and a mirror universe and time travel and everything within, like, you know, within 20 episodes or so. By the time you're through with 20 episodes of the first of DS9, you had gone from, you know, having, well, the story arc in the first season is absolutely nothing, right? You move slightly between, you know, Akira being really, really angry at the Kardashians in episode one, yeah, to her being on balance still angry, but willing to accept that maybe not every single one of them was a murderer. And I kind of feel like that kind of build-up is nice, and I hope we don't burn too bright like Discovery did. Although, even with Discovery, right, it's not all bad. They have had shows where they've pulled it back and they've been a bit more controlled.
You know, speaking of DS9, I hope when we do go into that episode, if we do decide to review if we could keep track on this one, like I hope to, maybe we should. But you mentioned Kira and the Cardassians, and I'm so looking forward to reviewing Duet. Where the Gull something comes on.
Goldar Heel.
Goldar Heel, yes. Yes. So I'm looking forward to that episode.
Actually, I was talking to the wife, and it was about, you know, with the new Star Trek, and it was I was talking to her about kind of, you know, what was so good, and because the wife hasn't seen Star Trek, she's not that interested in Star Trek, and I kind of told her about some of the episodes that I really like that I think are interesting, and they're not necessarily about like big space battles, or they're about like big earth shattering events or large stakes. I don't think you'd necessarily do sci-fi because you need the stakes to be large. And I was mentioning just a couple of them, like from, I think I gave her like four episodes from each of the series. And, you know, I did mention specifically Duet, which is a wonderful episode. It's a great episode that involves basically two people and someone coming to terms, well, both of them coming to terms with the consequence of basically government policy, the occupation, on their, you know, their personal outlook and how they treat others. I was talking to her about the offspring. So, you know, when Data does actually have his own child, and how much that brought in questions about, you know, parenthood, seeing your own child grow beyond you, the state wishing to take it away, you know, and also mixing humor and kind of like a loving story of an android that we've basically followed and become very attached to over the years. You know, and other episodes that I always consider to be like small episodes, but have a lot to say. There's the Voyager episode where it's the time skip forward episode where the Doctor's in the museum and he's talking about how the Voyager was perceived by a warring race, and it's about how you rewrite history to suit the victor, and then that has a great skip at the end where they skip even further into the future and you realize that you're actually watching a simulation of the simulation. And it's that kind of thing that I really, I mean, I'm not going to say that is what quote-unquote Star Trek is and nothing else could be, no other Star Trek is possible, but I kind of like, I do miss that the current series, at least, they don't seem to have enough space to allow those stories to be told. And I would really, if there's any way that you can, you know, whether it's through Discovery, which, you know, if it is Discovery, it's absolutely fine, or whether it's through Picard, if these big story arcs could allow those smaller stories to be told on the side, I think that would be great.
Yeah. So, there are, you know, like, what was the deal with the Data and the painting of the daughter? And it turned out, what was her name? Tosh?
Dahj. Dahj. Dahj.
Okay.
Because I actually heard a couple of people talking about it, and they always refer to it as Dodge.
Wait a second.
And it's like, no, you might land a Dodge with an American accent, but it's Dodge.
Dodge. Okay, so
like the first, like, you know, the first part of Darjeeling Tea.
Oh yeah, I don't know that. So who painted,
I'm sorry,
that?
That reference is just a million miles away. I apologize.
Oh, definitely. Who painted that, Data or before?
No, that was supposed to be Data. I I was under the impression that that would be Data.
Okay. So why was B4 showing up in his dreams?
Well, why do you think it was B4 showing up in his dream? In the way
he looked? B4 has a different appearance in Data. More of a less evolved appearance than Data.
Okay, I don't think B4 is the person that they were depicting. I think they were depicting Data to the best of their ability, and it was a little shaky, but I think it was supposed to be Data. Mm. And hey, were you bothered by the fact that he was in the First Contact uniforms whilst on the D?
I didn't even notice that, to be honest.
What? No, so the very, very first opening scene, right? It looks like they are, well, it looks like they're in 10 forward, but they're not in 10 forward. They're on another part of the ship. And they're on the Enterprise D, but they're wearing Star Trek First Contact uniforms.
Hmm.
But okay, I can accept it because it's a, what's it? It's a dream slash vision slash something else.
And that makes sense because you ever have dreams of situations that you are in daily? Like, let's say you're in a room that you work in every single day, but when you have a dream of that room, it's oddly shaped, very different than what reality is. So I could kind of see where that possibly could be.
Yeah, okay, I understand. And I do agree, and I think it's something that I'm not putting people up on. I hope that the people making the show are at least aware of what they're doing in terms of the canon. So if, you know, if in a couple of years time, or if in a couple of episodes time, I mean, it sounds as if they haven't got a clue what they're writing about, then I'm going to be slightly less forgiving. But where we stand at the moment, then yeah, I'm perfectly happy for it. For it to stand, that there are enough outs in terms of it being a dream that I'm not going to get too upset.
Okay. All right. So, okay. Well, then, overall, I mean, I guess we could, you know, incorporate Picard into the show and give it a rating. I mean, how would you rate this first episode on a 1 to 5?
I think I'd probably give it a 4. I thought it was good. It's showing signs that... So one of the big problems, I think that a lot of Discovery's on Fast Forward, and I think a lot of the Picard pilot was also on Fast Forward, in particular the second half. If it just happens that that's the only part on Fast Forward, and they're trying to tell a story and get into a position, then that's fine. So I think, you know... Let's hope that they've got the plan for the series, and let's hope that they have space to breathe as it goes further. If it's going to remain at this level throughout, it might get tedious and tiresome, and then you might look back on the pilot slightly less sympathetically because it would have been, you know, it wouldn't have been them setting up, and as a result there's a lot of movement, but it would have been just a very typical kind of fast-packed, lots of action and not much in terms of direction. But overall, you know, given it the benefit of the doubt in isolation, and I would happily give it 4 out of 5.
Okay. All right. Yes. I was thinking 3.5, and the only reason is
that's nearly 4.
It's nearly 4. It's for all intents, I'll say 3.51. So yeah, we're leaning towards 4. I'm looking forward to new other people showing up because I mean they were our heroes, and I know Riker will be on. And I even saw something on Facebook that somebody predicted that Riker not only has children, but one of them might be a daughter. And I thought, boy, that's pretty darn futuristic thinking on this person's part, since the trailer has a girl's voice screaming, "Dad!" as Riker is doing dishes or cutting food or something. So, boy, they may have something there. We see Riker as a family man. I'm looking forward to... Didn't see anything about Marina coming on.
Oh, no, I think she's on. Yeah, she's on.
Good. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, they're going to... I hope they show Riker's family life and what he's been doing, because Riker sure has put on a great deal of weight just from the previews that I've seen.
Dude.
Wow. Well, hey, what are you going to do? We all get fat and ugly when we get older.
Oh, don't say that. Don't say that.
Oh, let's see. You know, Jerry Ryan will be on. So we're looking forward to a little more.
Hang on a second. She hasn't put on weight as she's got older. No. I mean, she's 20 years away from when she was on Voyager.
Just about. Yep. I mean, yeah, she still looks hot. I mean, you know, 40 of triple D is what I call her. You know that. And
we've had discussions about that in the past, yes.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I'm looking forward to this as well. I mean, hey, it's Picard, who arguably the best captain in Starfleet. I don't know. I don't know how I can rank Picard higher than Sisko. You know, he's definitely higher than Janeway, who I also believe is higher than Kirk. So the show that starts it all, the captain of the original USS Enterprise, ends up last in my list of captains, to be honest. I hope everybody didn't just click off right now.
Well, hang on. So the thing is, if you're talking about within the universe, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Janeway obviously gets promoted to admiral and very quickly kind of, you know, becomes more senior than Picard on the basis of getting the crew back. Kirk basically becomes a loose cannon, right? And he goes against Starfleet and stuff. And he might be quote unquote historic, but you know, Kirk is never going to end up head of Starfleet command or having like a desk job per se. I mean, and I think that was clear throughout. I mean, it's basically the plot of Star Trek Motion Picture, Star Trek Wrath of Khan, and Star Trek in Undiscovered Country. They all wrap up this idea that Kirk ain't going behind a desk. Now, in terms of Picard, he's the quintessential captain, because Sisko certainly is, and Sisko went on a mission, did his thing, became a spiritual leader, and then died. So
Sisko didn't die. He died. A prophet.
Well, yeah, okay, sure, but I mean, what do you reckon it says? Okay, so I'll put it this way. Okay, I imagine Starfleet has pretty good death in service benefit.
You think?
Now, do you think Cassidy Yates claimed? Because I'm sure she claimed, and as far as I'm concerned, that means he's dead.
Mm. She's making his pension, huh?
Without question.
Okay. Oh, and I did forget Archer. So I think Kirk is above Archer. So Captain Kirk didn't land last in my list. Archer did. In fact, I even think Porthos. No. Porthos. God, what
Porthos
was that?
Porthos was the dog.
Yeah,
the
Porthos was ranked higher than Archer. But anyway. The dog ranks higher than the captain. So anyway, let's go back to Face of the Enemy. Okay. So, this is the 14th episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. It was first aired on February 8th, 1993. Teleplay by...
So nearly 30 years ago.
Long time ago. And it's getting worse every time we go 3 months between episodes. But anyway, teleplay by Naren Shankar. I am terrible at names. Story by Rene Echeverria. And directed by Gabrielle Beaumont. And I did not know, but Jerry Taylor is a part of this episode, and I will get into that later. Because I was thinking, boy, they did pretty good having Troy as the Tal Shiar representative, so to speak, and the captain being female. I like the fact that two females were in charge, large and in charge. And I said, I even put in my notes that I don't think Jerry Taylor had anything to do with it, which then I found out later, sure she did. So now I understand more. Oh, yeah, she was listed as co-executive producer.
I mean, but we have had Jerry Taylor stories already, right? She joined earlier in the season.
Mm-hmm. See, and I think Jerry Taylor is known for, you know, when she's directing, I believe. Doesn't she direct?
No, she's a writer. She's a writer.
Okay, well, she's a writer. When it's her stories, they highlight the females, and that's good. I like seeing Captain Janeway, but you could tell it's a Jerry Taylor story if it's female centric. But I thought, well, this is one that isn't. But yeah, co-executive producer.
Well, you know that Rene Echeverria, he got fan mail that it was very clear that the people on the other end assumed that he was a woman.
Mm.
Because of obviously the name has it, not it depends on how you spell it, of course, yeah. But it has a relatively close female form. And they assume that Rene, I can't remember what it was. But I think it was one of his early episodes. I think it would have been. I'm going to just misspeak if I try to guess. But again, it was a smaller centric episode, more on less on Bang Bang and more on a talk. And I think the assumption that was made was that it would have to have been a woman that wrote it.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, and I just, as I'm looking at Memory Alpha, a picture of Bruce Maddox just came on the screen. Is that fate or what? Because I was just looking and thinking, they actually talk about Bruce Maddox. Does he lose his mind in Picard? What happened there?
Okay, so here's the thing about... I'm going to say something about Maddox that I don't want to see Bruce Maddox, and I don't particularly want for it to be Bruce Maddox-centric. Yeah. Because there's one thing I don't like. There's one thing I like about the Star Trek universe when it's done right, which is that it's a very big, very wide universe. And you can have stories with a lot of people interacting, and I don't think you need to have connections between all of them. Mm-hmm. Now, I do like the fact that, look, it's very likely that some of these connections are natural. So I had no problem at all Dax claiming that, she knew Riker when they were on DS9, when the Enterprise came to DS9 and they partied. Because I can believe that Riker's the kind of guy that would have partied with Dax. That stuff's absolutely fine. What I don't want to see is I don't want to see kind of minor characters that have been in Star Trek episodes become more important. And in my mind, it kind of has the effect of making the universe smaller. So when you start bringing in these connections, in one way you can think that, isn't it nice that they're they're giving us Easter eggs here and there? But I think it often like narrows the story to just a few characters. And I have to say that in my opinion, or my experience of the Star Wars universe. I'm not a huge Star Wars fan, but I have seen the last, the latest trilogy, and the way they try to wrap people up so that it's, this person's son and this person's daughter then carry on this thing into the future. I'm so over this, like, layer upon layer of connections with only a few actors. I want to see a wide universe with lots of possibilities rather than a very, very narrow kind of two family affair kind of thing. So as a result, we obviously know Data's important and Data being name checked and being part of the story, I can accept it. I can accept Spock being part of some Discovery stuff. But let's stop with this bringing on Harry Mudd and Bruce Maddox and stuff like that. I don't need it. That they're not important people. They were never central. So let's hopefully be confident with the story and the characters we create without having to, having to go back and reference. I don't need to see Ensign Rose's daughter, for example. It's not necessary.
Okay. Yeah, and I remember there was part of it that said, synthetics were now illegal, so that makes Data illegal. They're going to have to get flush further into the story for me to really understand what they're doing. So I need to watch it again. I'll admit that. Okay, so anyway, Face of the Enemy, co-starring, our guest star, that is, co-starring Seth MacFarlane as Nevek, Carolyn Seymour as Tereth, and she's actually in a few Star Trek episodes, Barry Lynch as Deceve, Robertson Dean as a Romulan pilot, Dennis Cockrum as a Corvellian freighter captain, who gets blown up in a few seconds, Pamela Winslow as McKnight, and of course, Majel Barrett as a voice of the computer. So what do we think about this episode? I'm going to go first. I think it's great. I like this episode. It's a terrific one. And the main actress in this is pretty weak in this series, as we all know. I'm not a big fan of Troy, but I am in this one. She knocks this one out of the park. The two main women in the episode going at each other, I think it was wonderful. Wonderful. They did a real good... I think this is some really good writing. She starts out a little slow, because obviously she's in shock as to what the hell is going on. What am I doing here? Why am I here? But then eventually she starts to fit into those boots that she wears just wonderfully. Good one for me. What about you, Doc?
No, I have to. I think I generally agree with you on this. I think that we have a very strong guest star kind of come in and go up against Troy, right? There's certainly no lack of ability on that front. So it's not as if you can kind of claim that, oh, there was a bad guest star that didn't pull their weight or anything like that. It's all very good. There's a part of it that when I did rewatch it, I kind of thought, oh, it's not quite hitting the highs that I seem to have remembered it hitting, like back in the day. And I'm not entirely sure why that was. And the more I thought about it, do you remember the episode when Kira got abducted and then she got turned into a Cardassian as part of the ploy, and you think, oh, actually, they've done this thing before. This is the original. I mean, is this the original? We're going to take you. I suppose it might not be, right? it might be Mirror Mirror that's the original. We're going to take you and put you into a situation where you have to act differently. But overall, I think that this is good. It's very nice for Troy to have her own episode to be able to, frankly, to be the focus of attention. That's perfectly acceptable, and I think she does. She does well. Talking about kind of closing in the universe, I would probably be a hypocrite if I didn't mention about the fact that this obviously builds on to the reunification arc that they've got going on in TNG at this time on Romulus. I think this is the last we hear about it. It's not quite the fact that they drop reunification after this going forward is, might be seen as a pity, because it's an idea that was put in there that basically simmers away. But overall, yeah, I certainly like this episode. It could have been better, but not a huge amount to complain about. Let's dissect it and let me put my thoughts together a bit better.
So we wake up in the beginning of the episode and stumble around in the dark, kick the cat, whack our baby toe on the bedpost, scream for a few seconds with every curse word that we can think of, beginning with bollocks. And then we find the light switch in a room we've never been in, to a mirror we have no idea that is even there. And we turn on the light to find out that we've been surgically altered to be a Romulan. And after a bit of startlement, if that's a real word, we don't pass out with fright. Now that's the most amazing thing, because I probably would have been like, out like a light. So with our mouth open, we cut to a commercial. Do you think, this is a very important question here. Do you think all Romulans sleep in their boots, or do you think they just threw it down on a bed?
Okay, so clearly the Romulans don't—they don't sleep in their boots.
Okay, I'll accept that. But I guess maybe they didn't have time to undress her and put her in a nice little nightie or something. They just had to throw her down and Let it happen.
I mean, that would have been a bit creepy, wouldn't it? I mean, they need her to be ship shape and ready. So obviously, she also wasn't asleep. She was drugged.
Yeah.
Actually, I like it when she gets up and goes, "Whoa, I'm feeling a bit woozy," and instead of saying, "Oh, you know, take your time," they go, "Broop, yeah, no, you've got a little bit in your system, but you'll be fine now." Now shape up, dude.
Yeah, relax. Yeah, just do what I say. But when you were watching this opening, and you could see clearly a Romulan uniform going from the boots all the way up, and of course the top of it was dark. But then you see this, you hear this Romulan get out of bed, and you hear, "Computer lights, computer, turn on the lights." At that point, did you realize that was Troy?
Okay, so here's the thing. I think that it's hard to remember me watching this episode for the first time.
I know.
And it's also hard. I don't think I recognized Troy's voice. That's one thing. I don't think I did recognize the voice because, I don't think I'm very good at recognizing voices in general. And certainly back then, I wouldn't have been. Wouldn't have immediately picked up on it. However, having said this, I'm pretty sure this episode came out on VHS with a picture of Troy on the front cover in Romulan gear. I'll try to find out if that's true or not. So it would have been somewhat of a spoiler.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, okay. All right, so there, that was the teaser. What do we think of the teaser of her turning on the light? Thing. It's all good. Yeah, we really need that little handheld device that gets rid of scars and cuts and so on, because boy, that's a pretty darn good job that they did on her face to surgically alter her to be a Romulan and not have like bloody scars all over, bandages all over. You gotta figure, I want that technology. Okay, so the opening. It started out okay. We know it's Troy. She's begging the computer to turn the lights on. And she doesn't even have a headache. That's another part of it, too. So they did a really good job on dressing her up. Of course, she's shocked. She's frightened. And she's asking, "Who the hell cut my hair like this? What is it with the Romulan bowl haircut?"
It reminds people that they have a Romulan that they're watching.
Yeah, if the uniform doesn't remind them already. That is one dog ugly uniform, really. And what happened to all her hair?
Well, I don't think she has... It's not her hair, right? It's actually a wig that she's wearing. As in, Marina Sirtis is wearing a wig throughout TNG.
Right.
However, it is odd when they do this, right? The amount of extra stuff they're carrying on their face, it must be a couple of pounds worth of stuff. And I don't know what they do to put it on, and I don't know what they do when they cut it off. When Sisko got transformed into a Klingon. does Dr. Bashir give him a little goodie bag to take home with all his extra ridges? I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, O'Brien made the worst ugly Klingon ever.
He did, didn't he? He really did.
He just did not look the part whatsoever. I'm also thinking white guys do not make good looking Klingons.
I was actually going to say not necessarily white guys, but ginger white guys.
Yes.
It's not quite the right look.
Right. It doesn't work. So anyway, okay. So after the commercial break, the first officer of the ship, Nevek, comes into her room and tells her how to act, not only as a Romulan, but as a member of the Tal Shiar.
And this is the first reference of the Tal Shiar, is it?
I believe so. I don't remember hearing Tal Shiar in the past, because there's only been a few Romulan episodes.
I agree.
What's his name? We are back. And then, a couple other things.
So that's a reference to the first season and we'll always have Paris.
Yes. yes.
No, the neutral zone. The neutral zone. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It's the neutral zone.
Yes.
We are back. Imagine we've just watched Picard, right? Yeah. So in Picard, it's like bang, 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 bang. By the end of the first 45 minutes, you've gone, you know, there are assassins out there. There are sleeper agents, basically Cylons out there within the Star Trek universe. There's a huge Romulan enclave that's inside of a Borg cube. And, you know, that's how they finished the first episode. In TNG, it took us into the 24th episode for the Romulans to turn up. And all they do is they say at the end of the episode, we are back. And then it don't show up until what? Like the Price or the Enemy, I think it might have been, you know, 8-9 episodes down the line. How times have changed.
Well, we did have the Romulan who tapped in on the transmission and... God, I'm having trouble remembering. It was it was another galaxy class starship that was looking for the Iconians.
Yeah. Well, hang on. So that was Contagion.
Yeah, there you go.
And that starship was the Yamato.
Yes.
USS Yamato.
Yes. Blows up right, and you know, and he says, "Donald, would you like us to get any of your people off of your ship? It looks like it's in trouble." No, I don't think we need to do that. And of course, they all die, blow up. You know, all the crew, all their spouses, all their children, their dogs, and, their cats, they're all dead.
And yet you still rank that guy above Archer in the list of captains, eh?
No, I didn't not Donald Volley. He's pretty damn low on the, you know, it's his fault his whole crew is dead. He just had to go off on some kind of crazy expedition. But we don't need to rehash that one again. Okay, so the Tal Shiar, which I would say, you know, describe it as the Obsidian Order for the Cardassians or Section 31.
That's the other way around, right? The Tal Shiar were first. Obsidian Order came later.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But actually, in a way, I think we know more about the Obsidian Order because of, you know, how much DS9 kind of looped them in.
Oh, yeah. They did a good job on that. We only hear about the Tal Shiar in this episode that I can recall so far.
Yeah, but then we obviously see it a bit in DS9 and during the Dominion Wars and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So anyone who defies a Tal Shiar are either executed or imprisoned with their families who had nothing to do with whatever the convicted person did in the first place, but that ain't going to stop them.
So the way you read that, it made it sound like you're going to be imprisoned with your family. And it's like, nope, that's a fate worse than death. Yeah. Imprisoned people, with your family.
Some people are already imprisoned with their family.
You mean even Uncle Bob that I don't like? Yeah, especially Uncle Bob.
Uncle Bob. Yes. Yeah, anyway. So what do we think of the Tal Shiar? Are they... Do you think they're needed? That kind of, what do you call it? Department of the Romulan Empire. Do you think that kind of stuff is needed to ensure loyalty to the Empire? The Obsidian Order, Section 31, are these things really needed?
So I think the answer to that, from the story perspective, I think they're a good addition because we've already started to see talk about the military and how the military can like effectively run in the state through unification and stuff like that. So we know that there's like a big grip on the military. And then I do think that having effectively like a secret police, which is I think effectively what the Tal Shiar are, I think that adds a nice new, an interesting look to it. And it also, it also introduces a dynamic, right? Because the military, they are in charge in a way, but they're also the people that are making it through the military are being vetted by the Tal Shiar on the side so that you don't get many kind of reasonable people in the military rising up the ranks because those that dissent kind of fall victim. And so you've kind of got a bit of black ops going on, which is shaping the future leaders. And then you've obviously got the dynamics with the citizens as well, of which we see a glimmer through Spock's storyline. And I think that it builds a more rich society than just a case of, if they were just to say, like, hey, the military are in charge, hey, it is what it is. I think naturally people would have questions as to, well, why aren't the good people taking over? Surely there are a couple of guys in the military that would back kind of a democratic movement or something like that. And I quite like the fact that the Tal Shiar at least add a little subtlety to the culture, because if you don't have this understanding, you almost have to walk away with the assumption that Romulans are bad, and that's it, just bad. So I think it adds a nice development to the culture that makes them more than just a one-dimensional villain.
Romulans are bad and the Tal Shiar are worse. Okay, so you believe it's an effective deterrent to obedience?
Yes, I think so. So yes, I think that's what they are. So from a storytelling perspective, I think that they're making a nice kind of three-dimensional view of the population. What they are effectively doing here is that they are, they have like the state police in charge, the state police having a large influence over the people who effectively are in charge of the society, which is, the military leaders or even the civic leaders. So I think that there are certainly models, and there are things you can point to in history where that kind of regime has been successful. Not necessarily successful in the long term, but successful during periods at keeping countries together. I don't look at this development and think, well, that's not going to happen or that's unrealistic. I can certainly buy into the story that they're telling here.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I find it fascinating that everybody was so afraid of the Tal Shiar, except for maybe the Romulan commander. I thought she had some guts to her. I mean, she argues with the orders and pushes every button at the start. During the episode, she becomes even a little bolder and a little bolder. So what do you think of the commander of this ship? Like I said, played by Carolyn Seymour. What do you think of her going up against the Tal Shiar, or what she believes is the Tal Shiar?
I mean, so I think it makes sense, because I imagine that, I think it's always bad to develop stories that are very kind of black and white. So I'd imagine even if you did have a secret police, if you did have people like that, the most junior guys on the ship would be pretty very very scared of them. And the more senior you get, you might start getting into people that either dislike them more or frankly might like them more and might have tendencies to agree with their methods or not. And now it's clear that the commander does not have enthusiasm for the Tal Shiar, and under those circumstances, I think it's perfectly believable that she would, she would bat back at them, whilst obviously remaining in a position where she's not, disobeying orders. Right. So she's standing on the right side of what she's allowed to do, and actually, frankly, I think it's we often see Picard having discussions with Starfleet. He doesn't just follow orders blindly, but you're always given the impression, because we obviously don't see it, but we're always given the impression that on the other side people are just taking orders directly and don't think about the consequences. And I like the fact that in this episode we explicitly see that the commander pushes back against the orders, does argue, and it means that going forward, we see the Romulans as not being just a uniform bunch of savages with the same kind of viewpoint, but there are discussions, there are arguments, and there are different views, within the military themselves. Mm-hmm. I always like this stuff. This is good character building, or world building, I suppose, in this particular case for a Star Trek and frankly, it's been around since the beginning, right? Since the very beginning. It was like 9th episode in Balance of Terror. And we have obviously learned not as much about them as we have about the Klingons and even others in the others in throughout TNG. I'd say by this point we know more about the Ferengi and the Borg than we do about the Romulans.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so they give Troy the name of Major Rakal Tal Shiar. So Major Rakal, I'll call her, arrives to the bridge, and the commander sizes her up immediately. It was pretty cool, asking, "Why are you here without your guards? Do you think that was a oops on Nevek's part, not having two people pretend to be guards to be with her or something?"
I don't think he would have had the... from a story perspective, I don't think he had the opportunity to do so. So I don't think they could have had extra people. I wouldn't have imagined. But what I think what this does, right, it immediately puts you in a position where Troy's been told that she has authority, she has power, and straight away this woman kind of bats at her and knocks her off balance and says, "Look, where are your guards?" And it's like, Troy's obviously thinking, should I have guards? How do I explain away the lack of guards? A similar situation comes up in a little bit where they ask about, well, where did you study? Who did you study under? What do you think about his teachings? And it's not, you don't know whether or not the commander knows something more than she's letting on, or whether it's just an honest query that gets Troy on the back foot, given the circumstance they find themselves in. But I think what happens is that the viewer's left with a very clear view that something's, that this is not going to be easy. And Troy's mission of saying, "I am from the Tal Shiar, you do what I say, you do, if you question me, then I'll have you executed," it's not going to be as smooth sailing as that.
No, they have to knock her back a little bit, get her on the ropes, as it were. Okay, well then, so then the commander asks, "What is this mission?" But, I can't reveal that. Why not? Well, that's a dumb follow-up question. If she can reveal why she can't reveal the mission, then she might as well just reveal the mission. So, but I do like their back and forth. Like you said, I mean, they're sitting at dinner in Troy. Could you possibly take this away and give me a chocolate sundae, please? No, she can't do that. She's got to eat along with them. Could you do that?
Yeah, actually, so that was good, because they specifically asked Troy for something that she's not familiar with, and then she has to think on the hoof. And I think that this gives you, as someone who I suppose are thinking that let's make sure that Troy completes her mission, you're now thinking, oh dear, the mission's in peril just because she doesn't know what, what buffalo wings are. I mean, right. It's like, so it's actually quite fun. I like this a lot.
Yes. Yeah, do you like your Venerine? I've smelled better Venerine on prison ships. What is she doing on prison ships? Well, that's a whole different story. But whatever. Okay. Let's see. I lost where I was. I'm sorry. This follow-up question. So after a slight dance on the bridge, as I call it, Rakal ends up with some pretty obviously leveled threats. If you don't want to have another run-in with the Tal Shiar, here's another question. During that dinner, I think it was during the dinner, the Romulan commander talks about her old man. Her father pulled out of their house by the Tal Shiar. If that's the case, and the family shares in the crime or the punishment, how did she rise to the level of commander of her own ship if the Tal Shiar had a run-in with her family?
Well, these things, I mean, even when they were being followed like on Earth, I think these things are never absolute, right? So I think in the event that this took place when, the commander was younger, they might, know, it probably would have been perfectly reasonable for them not to punish the kid. In the event that it's something that happens whilst he's already part of the military, I would imagine that as long as they can get the military person to denounce the family member, it's almost, you know, better propaganda for the state.
Oh yeah.
So I kind of think that, you know, it sounded to me like what the guy did wasn't that much. It sounded like he just, you know, he went on a peace march or something like that.
Yeah.
And then kind of got a bit of a, what you know, what are you doing? And, you know, we're not going to follow you. And we kind of think you're a threat. And, you know, you're, what are you going to do? Turn vegetarian next? That kind of thing. So it sounded very low level. But I didn't think there was any contradiction with the, you know, with the state, you know, coming down hard on this particular commander. And I think that they would have probably just got the family to denounce him. Because in a way, by the way, that's, you know, that's almost worse, right? So if someone steps out of line and does go on a peace march, and then they get denounced by their family and they get kind of, you know, thrown in a prison somewhere for 6 or 7 years, it's, yeah, that's worse than the family standing behind them in a way.
Okay, so where are we going? We're going to the Caleb sector, 102 Mark IV. Say it again. 102 Mark IV. One more time. 102 Mark IV. Why are we going there? That doesn't matter right now. We're going to pick up some stuff. That's all we know. But in the meantime, let's go to the Enterprise, where we have a homecoming. A Federation defector would like to come home. I don't know why, because maybe he misses a tomato soup. You know, the replicator can't make tomato soup. Or, you know, he just wishes to spend more time. You know, he's tired of being free, and now he wants to go to a Federation prison for the rest of his life. Okay, that's not really it. He actually did it for Ambassador Spock, who has a message for Picard. What do you think of the whole ensign coming back after 20 years with the Romulans and doesn't know what the word rendezvous means? He said he would like you to rendezvous in the Caleb sector.
No, that's fine. I don't particularly mind that. I mean, this is very reminiscent of, like, during the Cold War, when you might have had, like, an American defection over to Russia, and under the assumption that they're going to live in a better society, in a better way of dealing with things, and then, like, realizing 25 years later that actually maybe not. And I think that really it's just that, you know, he's obviously got used to the Romulan ways and the Romulan speech. I assume he's fluent in Romulan, and he would have been crusty in terms of English. Because I imagine he's not using his universal translator when he's out, or when he defected. But yeah, I kind of thought, yeah, I didn't mind this. Right, I thought it was a little bit odd that so this guy managed to get out by walking back. So he's obviously a defector that came in. He's obviously a person of significance within the Romulan state, and they allow him to leave. Now, I know that the other guy that they were trying to get to leave was a senator and some senior advisors, who's probably more senior. But in a way, if you're more senior, you might have access to more impressive means. You might have access to your own ship or a shuttle or something else. So I always found it odd that the defector managed to get out quite, you know, straightforwardly. But the senator kind of had to go through this whole rigmarole in order to get out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, somebody had to get to Picard and tell him what to do. So they had to get him out somehow. Okay.
I would have thought that had it been like a prisoner exchange, it would have been a bit more, it would have made sense. So had the defector come back because the state had chosen to, you know, hand him over for a prisoner that had been caught on the Federation side, you know, because then you would have aligned interests for him being sent back, and then, you know, he would have taken the information with him, but in a way, the Romulan Empire wouldn't have been too unhappy with him leaving, because they obviously knew they were going to get someone back in exchange. And by the way, what happened to what happened to those like torpedo-like ships that Kayla was on, where you could just fire them in and they can travel at warp 9.9 for a couple of years before being picked up somewhere? Surely that's the way to get these people out, right?
Sure. Yeah. They only use technology like that one time and then they never do it again. Even though it'd be really great if they did it again. They just don't. So, one of the things...
Hang on a second. Didn't they do that in Lower Decks? Didn't they send someone into through a...
No. No. They Sito.
Yeah, I thought Sito got shot out in a...
No, I thought she was just on an alien ship to infiltrate Cardassia.
Or maybe they were going to say that she was going to be sent back through one. I don't know.
Yeah. We got time before we get to that episode.
Well, we'll get there.
Oh, yeah. So, okay. So, the defector. I keep blanking on his name, but it doesn't matter. Because you know, he's a bad guy anyway. Oh, it's right here. Deceve. D-E-S-E-V-E. Deceve? Deceve? I don't know. He's looking heavy in his Deceve. So, but he says the Romulans are a very moral people. A moral people? Do you really see Romulans as moral people? Are they like to them to each other very civil, very friendly, very nice? But then, except for the Tal Shiar, that is. But then, to other races, are just savages? Or how do you see the Romulans compared to very moral people?
Well, I mean, when you say you're moral, I mean, I always assume what he means in this is that, and when they speak about like the Klingons being moral or the Vulcans, I always assume that he's talking about there is like some code of ethics or code of conduct that they follow. Now, that code might be different to ours, and it might be completely different to ours to the extent that, hey, it's perfectly reasonable to sacrifice every third child to the sun god. But to me, I always interpret this as, it's not based on our values, but it's based on their own values. So, you know, basically the opposite would be that it's just like a free for all where there's no common, you know, there's no common agreed way of behaving across society. So I think he's saying that, you know, as a society, they're quite unified, even if they happen to be doing things that we think don't align with, you know, our own moral compass.
That makes sense. So, but Ambassador Spock has a message and, you know, has a mission for him that will require a little bit of use of cowboy diplomacy. I liked it when they brought that back. So we have a Romulan ship heading for the Caleb sector. And now we have this message from Spock that says the Enterprise must rendezvous with the Covalian freighter in the Caleb sector. And now we know that the two stories are mixed together for something.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find out later what the mission is. Smuggle 3 Romulan defectors to the Federation. Vice Proconsul Moret and 2 of his top aides. That sounds easy enough. The only problem is a Romulan defector is almost a contradiction in terms. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to, you know, lay that out there like Picard does. It's almost a contradiction in terms. But it is a contradiction in terms. So what do you... Does it make sense that you got 3 top-level execudroids of the Romulan Empire defecting to the Federation? Why? What's their motivation for a better Romulus to destroy Romulus? What's their motivation here? I didn't quite understand what they were doing.
Well, I see. I mean, by the way, in this particular context, I see the behavior of the Romulans to be very similar to the behavior of the Cardassians, as that gets picked up in Deep Space Nine. I imagine that they just believe that the current governance structure with the military and the secret police, I suppose, with the Tal Shiar, is just not working, and it's loading, you know, leading to a very, you know, slow death of their society, and they're willing to kind of, you know, take risks and to do things that might change that. And we do watch it. We don't we get? I mean, we have had We do later on get change, right, with the Romulans, where, you know, we get the stuff that happens in Deep Space Nine with, I think, the youngest proconsul in history, or at least a very young proconsul. We then get the stuff in Nemesis when they end up wiping out their Senate. And then the clone of Picard becomes leader, or whatever that was supposed to be, and the Remans. So, you know, it's clearly there's an unease within their, you know, within their setup. I think if you then want to throw in, you know, unification as well, and them effectively being estranged from Vulcan for the last several hundred years, I think that also adds an element that might be pushing certain political change, or might be pushing certain structures to resist political change. So, I can see where that's coming from on this. Now, I think as we don't know a lot about the Romulan internal workings, you know, you can't say for certain that this sounds reasonable or not. And I think that from Picard's perspective, when he says it's a contradiction in terms, you know, he just sees one side, right? He just sees the public face of the military. And from that perspective, it does seem like a contradiction in terms. But I think that we've done a good job at least at describing the nuance of Romulan culture through the reunification episodes, that that at least I think this doesn't look too out of place in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That makes sense. All right, so let's see. The Romulan ship arrives with the Covalian freighter, ready to receive your cargo. He's lying. He has no intention of following through. Are you sure? I'm a freaking empath, you bastard. Yes, I'm sure. Okay. Boom! Blows that ship up. You think the Romulan military, love blowing things up. Why is this Romulan commander so pissed?
Well, things, I don't think they do like blowing things up, right? Yeah, I mean, we only see one side of their action. We don't see them, you know, we see after they pull the trigger, you know, are they willing to defend it? And yeah, we often see that they do defend it, that they do fire, and it looks like they fire first. But we're never privy to what happens on the other side of the camera. And that's one thing I like about this episode, is that you do see that, you know, things that we take for granted, like we assume that the cloaking device is all powerful and works perfectly, but they're a lot more cautious. We think that these guys are trigger happy and will blow up just for the sake of it, but these guys are actually a lot more cautious. And I actually think that rings true. Very often when you have an enemy, you just assume that they are your antithesis. And what this is just showing you is that actually they're pretty a lot more like us than we would have imagined.
Wow. Well, I mean, we do have the chase coming up here in a little while, so we find out they're a lot more like us. All right. Hey, James, can I put a pause on this for a second?
Yep.
I have a puppy bladder. I'm dying right now. Let me get up. I'll be right back, bud. Hold on.
Okie dokie.
I'm so sorry. I don't know what's going on, but lately I'm noticing that I've got about a 10-minute lead-up time. I don't know, I'm developing a puppy bladder or something.
So what's a puppy bladder? And make sure you edit this out.
You know, well, you gotta go now. There ain't no time.
I've done the transatlantic flight to Vegas without going, so I'm fine.
Oh, I'm telling you. Yeah, as I get older, it's worse. Oh, I suppose that happens. Let's see. So we talked about how they destroy the Covalent freighter, and so when the Enterprise shows up to meet with that Covalent freighter, nope, nobody's here. Gee. I guess they need to look into that. But then they... Okay, so I watched this last week, and I'm trying to remember, did they detect that they were destroyed by a Romulan, or was it the Romulan warp signature in the area, and they go looking for the Romulan ship? Is that what happened?
So my recollection is not perfect. I thought that they obviously knew that it had been destroyed, right? Yeah. I mean, I said obviously. Did they? Yeah. I thought that they knew that it had been destroyed. They were looking around, and they found some kind of Romulan, fingerprint. But they didn't go after them, right? They just happened to...
They were just in the area.
They were just in the area at the time when Troi started to send her messages across, and then, you know, there's a bit of a, are you talking to me, kind of, what's going on? And then people started to, you know, pseudo-ram the ship. And, you know, and that stuff started. I think that there was very, very... I don't think they thought that there was a chance there was a Romulan ship nearby.
Right. They just know they couldn't find the meetup ship, so they call DeSeva to the bridge and ask why we're here, Admiral. No ships, no base, no weapons, no sign of any life at all. No, wait, darn it, that's a different one. But it's the same. But it's the same concept, you know. Why are we here? You promised to be a ship. There's no ship here. And he says the same damn comeback. I don't understand. Wait, are you that dumb? I just said there's no ship here. You promised me a ship. There's no ship here. What do you mean you don't understand? Because when they say, I don't understand, that makes them look guilty. I don't understand. Wow. Okay. Uh-oh. What the heck was that? Are you with me?
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you.
Wow, you disappeared for a second and it went... Do 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 do, and then poof, you're back.
No, I stayed connected all the way. At least I was hearing you all the way.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so they, like you say, they look around, and then finally, the Romulans see the Enterprise. Fascinating. So, do you think Troi was abducted because she was an empath? Because they said. He said we needed a Starfleet officer as a plan B type of thing in case something goes wrong. But do you think it was because she's an empath or she just happened to be the only Starfleet officer nearby?
Well, I kind of thought that what they meant was that they needed someone like security codes and stuff like that. Or at least the ability to shut off, you know. Some sensors. Having said that, I'm not entirely sure that Troi would have been the person that I would have gone to, because I'm not sure that she, would she be entrusted with, the deployment of the fleet? Would she have been entrusted with security access codes? You know, I'm not sure that her role on the ship as the ship's counselor would have given her that. Now, I think it's very, very lucky that she's an empath. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is that it's the Enterprise that turns up in order to sort this out, because they just recognize her. So, yeah, I kind of feel that it's... it was probably better to have a Star Trek Starfleet guy than not, but then it's an awful lot of work to have the Starfleet guy there, and it makes the first part of the mission much harder to succeed, right? Because Troy's going around not knowing, you know, what a banana split is, and having to bluff her way through dinner. So I don't know. I think it's a little bit convenient for the plot, shall we say?
Right. Especially since we just destroyed this Covellan freighter, we're going to head on to Drakken for ourselves and drop off this cargo. And you're never going to get through.
And actually, the only way that isn't it the only way that this story works is that Troy doesn't know what to do, so says, "Let's just stay here a minute. I'm going to have a think about this."
Yeah.
You know, had it been someone else, they probably would have gone off somewhere and would never have met up with the Enterprise.
Right, but she does eventually tell the Nereth, I'm sorry, the commander, you know, we're just going to take the stuff ourselves to Drakken IV. But wait a second, we can't get through there. I mean, they've got gravitic sensor nets. Oh, that's not a problem. How would Troy have the codes to the gravitic sensor net?
So how I read this, by the way, is that, you know how I was telling you that the Romulans seem more cautious about their technology. So they seem more cautious about firing. They seem more cautious about the effectiveness of the cloak and stuff. I think that the same argument goes the other way. I think they think that Federation sensors are better than they are. I think they're being cautious here. And I actually think that the guys, you know, the Federation guys are sitting there going, "Sorry, you're worried about the sensor net? I mean, we miss ships on the sensor net all the time that don't even have a cloak, so I wouldn't worry about the sensor net." So I thought that from each of the sides, whether it's us looking at the Romulans, believing they've got perfect cloaks and, you know, bloodthirsty attitude, or them looking at us thinking that we must have wonderful sensors, I think it was just people overestimating their opponents. And that's how I read that part.
That could be very well true. And that is true. You're right. You know, even in my past jobs, people think the cameras can do things that they just can't. Okay. So, but it's better that people believe that they can. You know, like they say, there's somebody watching us at all times. Well, no, there's not. But the point is, as long as you believe, you're going to stay clean. If people had an idea of what they could really get away with, and I'm not going to go any further because that doesn't solve anything. I'm pissed, by the way, but you can't tell. However, it's just a perception of what you can do in that person's mind that's even better than whether you can or can't. So I get what you're saying. So just as they're about to go to Drakken system themselves, the Enterprise shows up. And Tarath believes it's time to leave the area. Just get out of here. No. Let's see what they're up to. To defeat your enemy, you have to know its intent. Can they see us through our cloak? Maybe they can. Maybe they can't. Let's find out. And, you know, they do this collision course. Do you think they would have actually collided with the Enterprise?
No. I think that she's just testing. I think that because she's the one in charge, I think she can go very, very close, as in, you know, meters away, like really, really close. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think the Enterprise will, you know, so the Warbird knows exactly the situation, which is there's a ship, they have very clear regions on the ship, and they're going to walk very close to the ship. The Enterprise has at least a certain amount of uncertainty, so they think that there's a ship. So I think that the Enterprise is always going to be more cautious than the Warbird, and as a result, the Warbird is using that as a way of testing their theory. So they're not going to hit them, but they're going to go so close that they're going to call the Enterprise's bluff.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder how the story would have went if Picard said, "No, I'll just stand here, they're not going to hit us." But because he backed up, they all of a sudden knew that they could spot him. so it's time to destroy them. Nope, not just yet. Not just yet. Let's talk to them. Let's get them to drop their guard. And they do. So what do you think of the reveal when she comes on and says, I am Major Rakal of the Tal Shiar? Because I don't know if Picard, Riker, and especially Data can bluff through this. Because what causes that 10-second delay before they realize, oh, crap, I need to say something so her cover's not blown?
Well, I think that that's artistic license. Because I don't think they didn't just sit around going, ooh, ooh, and had like an orchestra playing in the background, some tense music. So I always take that as like, but yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. I mean, Data should be able to bluff, right? I'm always surprised when Data doesn't bluff, because he can do, you know, billions of calculations per second. He can, you know, he's supposed to be able to handle this. And of all the things that an android should be able to do, they should be able to process data quickly and then move on. So, you know, the time it takes Riker and Picard to, like, recognize the situation is one thing. But Data really should have had it recognized within, like, tenths of a second, hundredths of a second. But you often find with Data is that it's the opposite. It kind of, like, takes him longer, which...
Yeah.
I never quite understand why, what the logic there is.
I guess Dr. Soon never programmed that into him. If you see your friend as an dressed as an enemy, just go with the flow. Everything's good. No, I guess he wouldn't have any reason to be that way.
Yeah. In these circumstances, be really, really, really stumped. It's like, whoa. What's
<Yeah. that? laughs> Wow, what's going on here? Okay, so they lower their ship, and instead of beaming over, they fire on the Enterprise. But it's not just, you know, disruptor fire. In it was a transporter beam as well that bring these three defectors over.
Okay, I don't know how they did this, or how they think that they were going to do this without it being extremely clear as to what was happening straight away. Because you don't fire disruptors, and then... It's like, oh, the ship's still there, and it's all fine, and you know they're clearly going to have like a power output reading, right? Like the warbird's going to fire disruptors and then say, well, you know, we've now lost X amount of energy. They surely must, they must have been aware that this is really the only chance they have to, you know, as soon as they do this, they're found out, and not just in terms of Troy, but you know. Everyone, every last guy down the food chain, like the engineer or the guy pressing the button or whoever was in on it, they must be aware that this is like a death sentence.
Oh, yeah. It certainly was. Not only a death sentence, he got vaporized.
Well, if you get a go.
Yeah, you know, you're right, you know. It wasn't a Veronti disruptor, so it was a lot quicker. But still... Every time you see a guy get vaporized, it's always, ah! Did they really have time to feel the pain? Anyway, that's a different story.
Well, so they used to mention that when people got their heads cut off, like where they used to be, you know, where they would have the guillotine come down, The idea was that the head would be able to see the body and would react, which I don't think that's possible, but you do hear horrendous stories like that. I don't know to what extent that's just propaganda people are putting out there. But you would imagine that by the time like half of your flesh is gone, you're pretty much done, and your systems have shut off, right? That, you know, that there's, you know, if you think that the pain receptors that you have are a way for your body to be told, you better get running. Right? You know, that's really what the system is there for. It's like, you're in danger, you better get running. By the time you're down to like, you know, by the time you've been hit with a phaser and you're starting to dissolve, there's no getting away from that. So in a way, there's no reason biologically speaking or evolutionarily speaking that it should hurt. It's done, it's over. There's you know, if you're thinking about it in terms of natural selection, he who feels more pain whilst being evaporated through with a disruptor is not more successful in life. So those genes wouldn't have been passed down through the gene pool. Mm. Anyway, but obviously it's all for effect, and you always want to. It's always good to see a. It's not good to see, but they always like putting in the scene where people get vaporized.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
a bit like Darge. Such a weird name to say. She got vaporized. That was a weird way to go.
Mm-hmm. Vaporized. As far as, you know, like the guillotine thing, I don't know, because, you know, you have oxygen to your brain, enough oxygen to your brain to last for a few seconds, I would say, until, you know, all of a sudden, bam, it shuts down. But I guess the brainstem is, you know, closer down into your neck, right?
Well, I suppose the question is, you know, what's actually processing? What's doing the processing? And is the head self-contained enough to process the information that it'll be seeing whilst severed? I do not know. I don't have that answer.
That'd be interesting. So if their eyes are open, the last input they feel is a slice in the neck, the head hitting the floor and rolling around and seeing things spin around and then poof, they're done. That would be a weird way to go to feel your head rolling around the ground. Anyway, I'll go with vaporize if I have my choice on how to die. But they find out what happens and Nevek gets vaporized. And then they turn the gun on to Rakaal. But just as they start to... So they raise their shields. Do they have to have the shields down to do the cloak?
I think it's been mentioned that everything needs to be down for the cloak, so you can't have shields while cloaked. But I don't know whether or not you can safely cloak as your shields are coming down. So, I don't know.
Okay, because they cloaked and then they got Troy off the ship. So obviously they had a lock on her even though the ship was cloaked. But she gets back. Whew. Everything's good. I mean, Nevek died. Nevek said, a lot of people have died for this mission. Especially the true Rakaal. Why wouldn't the commander of... the ship just stop as soon as Rakaal or whatever beams out. She knew something that they took her. Why didn't she just stop, turn around, and go after him? It's like they just took off, I guess, because the Enterprise hits high warp and boom, they're gone.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the Romulans in this episode are being on their side at least. They are being more cautious. Mm-hmm. But I imagine she's not going to be going back to a happy time with her superiors, right?
Oh, no. No. Oh, no. She just gave up three top people of the Romulan Empire. Yeah, they're going to be a little pissed. She's dead. She's going to get vaporized herself. And her family. She runs in the family. Started with her father and then her. Enemies of the Empire. So, okay, so now Troy is back. She has her own face. And mysteriously enough, she has her own hair. Where'd all the hair come from? I mean, I assume the Romulans cut it to, you know, they put that bowl on her head and cut all her hair off, except for around the bowl. Where did her hair come from? Can Crusher grow hair? And if they can, why doesn't Picard grow some hair?
No, Doctor, I like it like it is.
Well, first of all, yes, that is true. But they can stimulate hair growth, right?
I guess. I mean,
I think they can. Because I thought...
I never saw a reason why they needed to stimulate hair growth, but maybe they can.
So I suppose when you go to Mr. Mott, it's not just having it cut, but potentially having it grown in other areas.
Mr. Mott, you cut too much. Would you put some back? Ah, not a problem. Not a problem. Okay. But then Picard doesn't grow hair.
It's actually a joke I always use with the hairdresser, I often use, and I'm sure that they hear it a lot. After they cut your hair and they say, "Ooh, what do you think?" I mean, I don't know what they're expecting me to say, because I usually take it down quite short anyway. The only option I have is, "Oh no, can you go longer?" Which is obviously not going to happen. So why even ask me?
I would answer that too. Well, actually, could you put a little back? It's a little too short.
I mean, the only thing I can say is, you know, either I'm happy or I'm not happy. That's it.
My goodness. I don't think I've used a barber or any kind of hairstylist in over 25 years. I got when my narcoleptic barber used to do a short flat top for $8, and then he retired because he couldn't stay awake. I went to a salon type thing, and they wanted like $35 for a haircut for a flat top, and I'm like, oh hell no. So I went to a Kmart, got me some clippers, and I have never went back. I cut my own hair.
Well, I have to say at the moment I pay far too much for the far too straightforward thing they do to my far too little hair. So it's stupid, yeah, what I pay at the moment, but I'm so busy with things that I haven't actually tried to sort it out or tried to do anything different.
Yeah, I'll send you some clippers and you just try it out. And I also about 1/8 of an inch.
I only cut it like once every like 12 weeks or so. I try to go once every like 3-4 months, and the wife always, well, no, she reckons it goes crazy, and in fairness, it does. It starts kind of growing outwards. In particular, the back of the hair starts growing outwards, and I start ending up with flaps around where my glasses are. But anyway, I'm sure Crusher, in addition to being a very good doctor, is a very good hairstylist.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Magic grow on her hair. She has that hair grow device that's next to the covers.
Well, I mean, fundamentally, if they can regenerate the skin, right? So they can, yeah, they can get rid of scars and cuts and things. Yeah. Surely that's stimulating growth. So watch where you wave that, otherwise you'll end up with, you know, wave it across the face and the beard comes out. That'd be a cool scene.
Yeah, well, Geordi tried that with the beard one time.
Hmm.
Okay. Well, yeah, I guess everything is done. We're done with this one.
I think we are.
Wow, this is a long one. I got a feeling we're going to have long ones with the Picard thing every week. Okay, well, then it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is the worst and 5 is the best. You get to go first this time.
Okay, I'm going to give this a solid 4 out of 5. I think it's an enjoyable episode, very well written, lots of nice character, lots of a good performance between with Troy and also the Romulan commander that's kind of come in for the episode. I think it gives us a nice view of the Romulan culture. It's nice to see a Troy-centric episode. It's probably one of the few Troy-centric episodes that doesn't have either A, a love interest, or B, her mother involved, and I think that she deserves this kind of ability to stand on her own and have these stories. I think it's a, you know, really solid episode of Next Generation. So thumbs up from me. And it's good that this was with Troy, right? Because it didn't need to be with Troy. It could have been with Data or Geordi, or I mean, I don't know if I've seen a Black Vulcan, but it could have been with any of them. And the fact that they chose Troy. I think that the dynamic between the commander and Troy was good, and that dynamic would have been different had they been of different sexes. But other than that, I certainly think this was a good outing on the Troy front. So 4 out of 5 from me.
Good. Yeah, I think Marina did a damn hell of a job, and you know, I usually discount her. And I think I've said before, I kind of wish they would have kept Tasha and got rid of Deanna. But they didn't, and Tasha wanted out. Or actually, what's her name?
Denise Crosby.
Denise Crosby wanted out, and she got out, and then I think she regretted it, just like maybe Will Wheaton might have regretted it when they leave. But hey, what are you going to do?
Why do you think that she would have regretted it? Just down to the money that they made on the show?
Well, like, yeah, simply as, because...
Simply
I mean,
that?
20 years later, these people are still involved with Star Trek. They're not acting in it, but they're still involved. I mean, look what all these conventions do every year. Multiple conventions throughout the world. And they go to them.
But do you think that Denise Crosby is less sought after than, say, you know, Gates McFadden? Or Will Wheaton is less sought after than LaForge? I'm sure Will Wheaton asks for as much money as LaForge asks for, right?
Well, of course, yeah. Yeah, you know, people love Wheaton. LaForge, maybe not as much.
I think the behavior around the fandom is important because, and by the way, Denise Crosby did the Trekkies documentary. So she's kind of got a bit of a, you know, when you go to the conventions, right, there are people you want to see and there are people you don't necessarily want to see. And I think that the way that the actor plays that, you realize that I think it allows them to get a good relationship with the fandom. And I don't think it's necessary just how long they stayed in the role for. So I'm sure that, so 7 of 9 did what, 4 seasons of Voyager, whereas Chakotay did 7. I know who's getting paid more when you go to the conventions, and it ain't Chakotay. And it's not Tom Paris either, right? It's clearly, Jerry Ryan. And the same thing with Kate Mulgrew. There's clearly a top tier there. And to a certain extent, it's about how they behaved in the franchise and how they behaved outside the franchise towards the franchise. And then also a bit of just, you know, oh, that's Kate Mulgrew. She's very famous. She does lots of fun stuff. But I always find it interesting as to, you know, the fandom effectively ranks the people that have turned up in the show. And it's not necessarily just longevity related. Some of it is slightly more subtle than that. And I find it interesting. Anyway, sorry about the tangent.
That's all right. What about Garrett Wang? Wong.
Did I say that?
What about Garrett Wong? I mean, he goes around all the time. People love him.
It is true that people do love him. I don't necessarily think people are paying top dollar for him. No.
No, they don't.
That's the only thing. So you can kind of see this. Actually, by the way, Blue, I've got a couple of... there's some news about conventions. The first one is that next year... Actually, no, not next year. It's now this year. The end of this year, we have Destination Star Trek back in London again. No need to go to Birmingham. And that's a particularly hard journey for a lot of us to make. So I appreciate I'm coming across now, at least to any of the English listeners, as being the most horrendously Midland/Northern phobe that there is. But there's a big difference between London-based convention and a Birmingham-based convention.
Well, there definitely is. You're right. And I've told you about Starbase Indy a few times. The first time I went to Starbase Indy in Indianapolis, Garrett was there. And I actually, you know, talked with him for quite a while as he was outside smoking. I mean, it's such a smaller convention where it's not as crazy as it was in other conventions that I've gone to. So you can actually spend time talking to these people as they're sitting there signing autographs. And when they don't have anybody in front of them, you could stand there and talk to them. And it's more friendlier, I think.
Okay, so I fully accept that there's that going on. However, what I'm also putting across here is my prejudice that I ain't going up north. The fact that I can go to have something very close to London is very nice. I think the conventions were about the same size in terms of attendance and things like that. But I do appreciate it being London-based, and I'll probably end up going. The other piece of news is that, hey, I have bought my tickets for Star Trek Las Vegas. So I previously announced that I bought my flight, but they hadn't, the tickets for the actual convention itself weren't on sale. Now, I should say they weren't on sale. They technically were on sale if you were prepared to pay $1,400 for tickets that included signatures and stuff like that. And although if I was pushed, I probably would. I was busy enough that I didn't. But they at the end of last week, they pushed out their quote-unquote captain's chair package, which is still ridiculous in terms of how much you're being asked to pay, which is, I think, $600 or $650. But I picked up those tickets. So I'm now, with the exception of not having a place to stay, I am now primed and ready to end up in Vegas again this summer. And by the way, that $600 isn't too bad, because when we do the Destination Star Trek Londons, you're looking at more than that for the tickets. For tickets, because what ends up happening at Vegas is that none of the talks are paid talks. So you get into all of the talks to listen to people. Whereas when you go to the London conventions, you end up paying $40 for the talk. So $40 per hour of talks you want to attend. And that's a little tough.
Is it? I mean, you could basically choose which ones you really want to see, and you don't have to see them all.
Yes, but when you go to a convention, right, okay, so first of all, it's very crowded. Second of all, you don't quite know what you're doing. Third of all, you're meeting up with friends and people and stuff like that. So the idea of having to schedule your talks ahead of time, because you obviously can't get tickets on the day. You have to get, or at least, you can only get tickets on the day for the talks that haven't sold out. And I like the way they do it in Vegas, whereby there's basically a seat in the main hall for everyone, for all talks, full stop. So there's never a capacity problem. When Patrick Stewart is talking, it will be full, but it won't be people being turned away. Whereas when they were running it in London, at least the last time I was there, the popular talks, maybe 10% of the people in attendance can turn up and see them, but the rest of the people just have no chance of getting in. So you have to then schedule your talks ahead of time, and you have to. It's too much organization for, frankly, what I think should be a weekend of lazing around and being very, being very kind of flexible with what you want to do and how you want to do it.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I was just looking at Caesar's website for the convention, August 8th through August 10th. They've got a room for $125 a night. And I assume that's probably going to skyrocket as we get closer and closer.
Okay, so I don't think it does skyrocket, and I'll tell you why. And something that so Vegas, don't underestimate how much capacity Vegas has.
Oh, yeah.
So, from a European perspective, by the way, and London has a lot of hotels. It has nothing compared to what Vegas has. A lot of the European cities, you do get squeezed on hotels. You do get squeezed that if there's an event, when we have the Olympics and stuff, you run out of capacity. Whereas Vegas, you go through it and you check. And I had to check the other year. So around this time last year, I had to book some last minute things for my wife for some reason. And you think, I hope there's capacity. I hope there's still openings. There's always capacity. And as a result, by the way, because there's always capacity, hotel prices in Vegas and in America, as far as I've found, are jaw-droppingly cheap compared to Europe.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, but then they get you on the resort fees as well.
What do you mean resort fees?
Oh, a lot of Las Vegas, the price of the room is an all-you-pay. They have resort fees. Could be as high as $20 a day or more things like the internet, the pool that you'll probably never use, a fitness room you'll never go in.
Sure, but just to be clear here, London, you go to a hotel in London, you go to a hotel that's equivalent to the hotel that we stayed in London, so when we was in, I was in Vegas with my wife, you're probably looking at $700, $800 a night.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so it's, and we probably paid like $200, $250 a night. So it's a complete different, you know, it's three times more expensive. So yes, there's, you know, there's $20 of resort fees. You have to pay the maid, all of that. Yeah, sure. But when you look at the European cities in particular, it is so cheap to go to Vegas and stay in, you know, to stay in the top hotels is really cheap compared to if someone is used to paying and having to travel around Europe. It's something that really kind of really surprised me. And also, food is cheap. Food's ridiculously cheap. Yes, okay, don't worry.
We better finish the thing.
Probably.
So basically, I said I usually don't like Deanna, but in this one, I thought she was really good. I think she handled herself brilliantly. Good character stuff here. Even the Romulans were pretty damned awesome. You know, she starts out as a confused Romulan impersonator, and she becomes what I could imagine a top-notch Tal Shiar officer. She got pretty ruthless there for a bit. The only thing she didn't do was just execute somebody, which I don't think Deanna could do. So I'm glad they didn't do that in the story, because it would make no sense that, you know, you want to see what kind of power I have? I'll show you. Kill him. Boom. He's dead. There you go. Do you want to see more? She could never do that, no matter how hard she tried. I don't think she could ever do that.
Well, also, it plays into the story later when she tries to become a commander, right? Excuse me.
Yeah.
Where she finds it very difficult to order someone to their death. It's obviously not like killing someone. It should fundamentally be easier. But yeah, I agree with all of this.
Yeah. But she knew what was at stake, as well as Nevek, and they were, you know, he was willing to die to see this mission. I'm not so sure she was. I mean, I don't think she had that much invested in it. As far as the story, I love the play between the two women in this episode and the cat and mouse game with the Enterprise. That was pretty good as well. You know, are they actually going to ram us? What the hell? The writing was brilliant. The direction was paced just perfect. And I've said before, my scores come as far as do these things go on car rides with me? And this one doesn't. This doesn't go on a car ride. Nonetheless, I believe it is a very quality episode. One question I wondered is the Tal Shiar, you know, I said it's the Tal Shiar makes a traitor's family. How did this woman rise up? But like you said, you answered that question. It sounds perfectly right. You know, you denounce the person and then you go on living. And that's probably what happens. And of course, she had to go home and say there was a Tal Shiar impersonator on board who brought three of our highest people in. They were delivered to the Enterprise. But none of it was my fault. So I don't know how she's going to get out of that. Let's see. All that's irrelevant. The story was pretty good. It's not a 5, no. It's pretty close. And I do believe in fraction scores. So, yeah, I agree. This is a 4 to 4.5. So I'll go in the middle and say 4.25. 4.27657. 4.25. And the doctor says it's a 4. So, all right. Well, then, anything else we need to discuss?
We do not need to discuss anything else.
Okay, then. Again, so far, the guests are beating us in the score. They like Star Trek more than we do. But that's all right. Didn't have a guest 2 weeks now in a row. We haven't had a guest. They're backing out on us. What's going on, man? Oh, that's right. You know, they expected these to be done months and months ago. So hopefully we can get some people back on. Because next week, Tapestry, we have Mark Stamper.
Don't say that.
I know.
We should probably check in on people before announcing that they're coming on.
Well, I'm hoping they're going to come on. If not, you know, I know people are busy. Like this one here with Matt Hansen. But, I mean, he's in law school. He just doesn't have time to do anything anymore. So...
So is this one of the things that when we scheduled it, he was about to go to law school and now he's about to leave 6 years later?
He's going to be a lawyer before we could do this.
Yeah, it's our fault.
Yeah. And he might want to sue us for it, too, because we promised him he can have it in good time. And, you know, oh, well, what are you going to do? So everyone join us next time as we review episode 15, and that is called Tapestry, as well as Episode 2 of Star Trek Picard. And I think I had it right here. Oh, yeah, it's called Maps and Legends.
Ooh.
So we'll do a little... That's what Star Trek Picard Episode 2 is called, Maps and Legends. Now, since we don't know anything about this episode, we can't really get an idea of why they call it Maps and Legends, but we'll find out, won't we?
We will. We will.
So join us next time, guys, and everybody, take care and good night.
Good night.